Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine.
Plus global business, finance, and tech news.
The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenovec from Bloomberg Radio.
As we mentioned yesterday, in the new double issue of Bloomberg Business Week, several stories on the destruction in Eastern Europe, including one on the new arms race that has to do with supplies and Russia and Ukraine having enough ammunition. Who knew there were ammo shortages? And so crazy to think that it's been a year since that Russian invasion of Ukraine.
Absolutely. And as you said, who knew that there were ammo shortages? Our business team, Business Week team, definitely knew. The new issue, by the way, online at Bloomberg.com/businessweek, also on the Bloomberg terminal, and of course, on newsstands. Let's get to it with Natalia Drozdiak. She's Bloomberg News reporter covering EU government. She's on the phone from Brussels, along with the Bloomberg Business Week editor, Joel Weber, of course, editor of the magazine. He's here in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker studio. I have to say, Joel, the coverage, really important, and as Maddie said, hard to believe that we're already 1 year in, or almost 1 year in on this.
Yeah, so to mark that, we wanted to create a package of stories, and in the ongoing effort to show how important return to office is, Natalia, who happened to be in New York from Brussels, floated, as I bumped into her one day, this idea that, you know, the world happens to actually be running short on ammo. And I said, wow, that has some serious implications when, you know, Putin has decided to wage war in Europe, right? And that is a coverage area that I just think is going to become even more interesting as the conflict rages on. But Natalia, bring us up to speed on your reporting and what you found.
Yeah, I think one of the features of this war in Ukraine that we've seen is the incredibly high attrition rates of ammunition that is taking place every day. Both sides are burning through as much as 30,000 155 millimeter ammunition, which is artillery ammunition, basically. And I think that has really taken the West by surprise. I mean, so much so that their stockpiles have also been depleted as a result of supporting Ukraine in its fight against Russia. And we know that Russia is also facing that pressure. I mean, just in terms of the staggering amount of ammunition that they're going through, that means that there's been basically this urgent need to boost production on all fronts, on all sides, in Ukraine, in Russia, in the West. And so there's this sense from speaking to officials in recent weeks that the war is really becoming a battle of factories and production as much as it is a battle of troops and weapons. And so there's this real race to produce as much ammunition in particular and to get that to the front, especially right now with both Russia and Ukraine launching new offensives in the coming weeks and months. So this is an urgent issue.
Okay, so you might have been tired of hearing about supply chains, but it turns out wars have supply chains too. Let's actually just focus on the Europe side and the what's going into Ukraine to support the Ukrainian side. Where is that stuff coming from, and what do the numbers look like as that machine has ramped back up?
Well, so both Europe and the U.S. have had to boost production. I think it's fair to say that the U.S. has been quicker to do it. They were producing around 14,000 shells per month before the war, and now they're planning to get up to as much as 90,000 per month as soon as next year. But Europe does seem to be lagging behind, and you know, we have some examples of companies in Germany and Slovakia who are really trying to boost production. But the problem is that Europe comes from this context of years of really limited defense spending, which I'm sure you will remember from the Trump days, because that was something that he was really pushing the Europeans to do more of, to spend more on defense. And as it happens, because Europe was spending in a limited amount on defense, on the basis of the assumption that there wouldn't be a major war on this continent, that meant that production and industry has also kind of scaled back on a big way as a result.
Hey, Natalia, I'm so sorry to jump in. I just wonder, I know you're talking about the Europe impact, but we've been talking all week about how the U.S. has also been limiting investment in defense. I wonder to what extent some of the sources that you spoke with in your fantastic reporting on this would be concerned about that as well, the U.S. potentially pulling back on investment in production of something like ammo.
Well, I think, I mean, the context right now, that would be really hard to justify, because I think there's just such an urgent need, not just to support Ukraine, but also to replenish the allies' stockpiles. And NATO allies just in the recent weeks and months have agreed to raise stockpiling guidelines as a result of that. So this is like a clear, concrete takeaway that they're making from the war and learning lessons from what they're seeing in Ukraine.
Natalia, I feel like there's a reality of, and you make a great reference to World War I when it comes to ammunition, but the reality is, you know, ultimately who is able to kind of bring in and build up their stockpiles could have a large impact on ultimately who maybe wins this war. So is there a net-net? Who has the advantage right now, Russia or Ukraine?
I think it's a really tight race. You know, when you talk to NATO officials, they're really confident about their position. They know that, okay, Ukraine's using less, but they're more efficient about the ammunition that they're using because they've gotten very modern weapons from NATO allies, mm-hmm. and those modern weapons are more precise at targeting, making those hits. And Russia's under sanctions. And Ukraine also has the backing of the entire West,
right.
Western production capacity, potential capacity. But yeah. on the Russian side, they've switched into wartime economy. So that means that defense has become a number one priority. So it's at the forefront. And we don't have concrete numbers about their current production of ammunition, but we know that before the war, they were producing 1.7 million 152, which is the Soviet standard for ammunition.
Natalia, I'm going to jump in here. I highly recommend everybody check out the series of stories, the photo essay, your story, though, with all the numbers, just talking about here we are almost 1 year in. Natalia Drozdiak of Bloomberg News and, of course, the editor of Bloomberg Business Week. Check out This Is the Cover and a special deep dive into the war in Bloomberg Business Week.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekdays from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live to our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Well, she ain't in the cars or pickup trucks, but if it runs like a deer, man, her eyes light up. She thinks my tractor's sexy.
All right, we're going to talk about tractors. Yeah, I guess they could be sexy. I don't know. Down on the farm, everybody. All right, shears of deer. They are, Romaine and I and the team, we were just talking about this. Deer jumping today, certainly one of, I think it's the number one gainer in the S&P 500. Reported first quarter results, beat expectations. They raised their forecast. Let's get into what is going on at the company, maybe what it says more broadly about the farm economy and the world at large. With us is Bloomberg News ag reporter Elizabeth Elkin. She's joining us via Zoom in New York City. And we've got Bloomberg Opinion Deals and Industrials columnist Brooke Sutherland right here in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker studio. Hey, Elizabeth, I want to start with you. Break down the quarter for us.
Yeah, absolutely. So like you said, we had a really, really, really strong day for deer today. You can kind of see how well farmers are doing based on how well deer is doing, right? So farmers are making a lot of money, which means that they're buying a lot of tractors. And so then you get deer making a lot of money off that, right? There are a lot of farmers who are going in and they're upgrading their fleets. You know, they need new equipment just like anyone else does. And they're upgrading and they're spending a lot of money, and deer is making money off that, of course.
So Brooke, bringing you into the conversation here, tell me a little bit about what this is looking like on the deal side. What are people most excited about when it comes to deer?
Sure. I mean, on the deal side, I think in the industrial world, it's just interesting to see, how these companies might behave if we see some valuation reset. We've heard a lot of companies complaining about prices being very expensive. Certainly, Deere has been making some inroads on the technology front, which, you know, we've seen that across the industrial sector of companies wanting to invest in these higher tech options for their equipment. I think what's interesting in today's numbers, it just really echoes what we've heard across the manufacturing sector this quarter, that they're not really seeing that dramatic drop off in demand that people have been worried about for so many quarters. Certainly there's pockets of weakness for deer, particularly that's on the more consumer facing side. Some of those sort of hobby tractors that were very big during the pandemic when we were all sitting at home and trying to figure out really, I mean, people who think tractors are sexy and we're excited to get out and do that during the pandemic. And so we're seeing weakness there, but in terms of their really more industrial facing businesses, it's just not happening there, and nor is it for a lot of the other industrial companies that I look at.
Brooke, go through some of the headlines and numbers that we got from Deere, though, that was so strong about, you know, they addressed demand, they talked about supply chains. Walk us through it a little bit.
Sure. Like Elizabeth was saying, you know, farmers are doing well right now. Crop prices are up. And, you know, there's some expectation that net income for farmers will be down next year relative to this year. But Deere still expects it to be at a very healthy level to support that replacement demand for this aging farm equipment that we've been talking about for years and years now. Right. And they are looking to invest. And, you know, Deere has also come out with higher tech offerings that can help improve farmers' productivity, which, of course, is very appealing at a time when crop prices are high and you want to get as much bang for your buck as you possibly can.
Is part of this, and let me first start with you, then I'll bring you back in, Elizabeth, is part of this the inflation story, that because farmers have they been able to charge higher prices? Is that part of it?
Deere has seen incredible pricing power, and they're not alone in this. But I think it is just notable how much Deere has raised prices, and it's somewhat similar to what we've seen at Caterpillar in terms of pricing power. But these are very big companies with very deep networks of dealers and service providers, and they have a lot of power when it comes to pricing, and they certainly have not hesitated to flex that in this environment.
But is it because farmers are making more money off their crops?
I mean, I think because that helps the farmers be able to absorb the higher costs, and you know, at the end of the day, if you need the equipment, you're gonna
want
to buy it. Of course, you know, there are competitors that you can look to in this field, but you know, like I said, Deere is a big company in the agriculture equipment space, and they have a lot of power.
There's not a lot of choices. Elizabeth, come on in on this and what we've been talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. So commodity crop prices are really, really high, and mm-hmm. farmers are, as we've said, making a lot of money off of that. We do, as we've been looking at this year or this past sort of year period, we've been worried somewhat about like farmers being able to outpace inflation, right? Because everything that goes into growing crops goes into like the farm, you know, like processes. We've seen like massive inflation on that, but so far crop prices have kept up pace more than so. And so farmers are kind of rolling in cash right now, and that's where we see this come in, right?
So farmers are rolling in cash. I wonder how much of this is the fundamentals versus the technicals for deer. Like, what is the exact data point that people are most excited about when looking at deer? And Brooke, I wonder if you can touch on that.
Sure. I mean, I think it's a variety of things. I think there was a lot of angst heading into this quarter, you know, that we might start to see signs of a slowdown. Deer, its stock is up significantly over the last couple of years. And, you know, I think people are wondering if, you know, there's an opportunity for some profit taking at some point here. But the company just keeps outperforming and blowing past
expectations.
It's
pretty remarkable. So I just went back to like 2018. I guess that was a little bit of a, 2018, I think, was a little bit of a down year, but they have just been shooting up year after year.
They have. And I mean, it's not just the agricultural equipment either. I mean, one of the things that stood out to me, just, you know, looking at the industrial sector more broadly, like I do, is their optimism around construction equipment, that, you know, whatever weakness we're seeing in housing, they still are seeing very strong demand for construction and forestry equipment. You know, as some of that institutional commercial spending comes in, you know, benefits from infrastructure spending, that sort of thing. So, you know, that's a focus for a lot of investors in the industrial side.
And I know, Elizabeth, that you cover this in a much more highbrow way, but I do wonder to what extent kind of the memification of deer and caterpillar has any impact on the companies. Like when we see everyday consumers just wanting to buy anything branded deer to kind of express their own love of the company, does that stay sticky? Does that remain a good sign for the company when you look, you know, a year from now, 5 years from now?
I mean, look, Deere is like one of these top names, right? I mean, I don't think that I can think about driving through, I went to school in Alabama, like I can't think about driving through Alabama without seeing a bunch of big green Deere tractors, right?
And the hats,
you know.
Do you know
the hats
make
the hats,
children's
and
books
that
too?
Really?
They have so much that you can buy to just be like, I love this brand. And they've done so much marketing around that. And I just wonder, I know that's a low expense, but I wonder if that has an impact on the health of the company.
I think it's a great thought. I mean, the branding is obviously really, really important to a company like this. And, you know, like you said, even like the hats and things, like those are things that I don't drive tractors, right? But I could still buy a bunch of like deer, you know, hats and shirts and things and like be like, yeah, I love big green tractors, you know, all of those country songs. Like I can still do that. So I would imagine that that is helpful for these companies, right?
I would also think that the brand power helps and plays a role in the pricing factor too.
Yeah.
You know, it's a well-known brand that people think of, and that gives them a lot of power.
You know, I'm looking at deer. So 2018, go back to the end of 2018, it's up at almost 200%. I mean, it's really just been on a tear. So guys, we just have about a minute and a half left here. Brooke, let me start with you. So when you look at the industrial space more broadly, we've had reports, you've got deer. What does it tell you about what's going on more broadly in the economy? I mean, as you say, these are not inexpensive machines.
No, they're not. But I mean, I think one of my biggest takeaways this earnings season has been CEOs' willingness to not only hold steady capital expenditures, but step them up. I mean, I think you have to feel like they're taking a pretty confident view of the economy here to be making these spending decisions, that, you know, there might be some sort of short-term dip, but they're looking past that and thinking about the long-term future of their companies and seeing a very robust demand backdrop, whether that's from reshoring or infrastructure or other stimulus programs in the U.S. and in Europe or China, and they feel good.
Elizabeth, come on in for a final thought here. Just got about 30, 40 seconds here, because I always think about, people think about farmers always needing subsidies, and it's such a tough industry. What does it say more broadly to you about what's going on in ag? And again, got about 30 seconds here.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it is a tough industry, but at the same time, like, you see huge commodity farmers, like, really making money. That being said, you also see some of the smaller farmers really struggling. And I think that you can see that in some of these equipment sales numbers. Small ag in the U.S. is looking down for the year. And I think that that's sort of telling of some of the smaller scale farmers rather than these big commodity farmers that we talk about a lot.
Well, the deer numbers, stock's still up about 7.3%. We saw AGCO going up, and we saw other names in the space definitely trending higher. Thank you both. Really appreciate it. Bloomberg News agriculture reporter Elizabeth Elkin joining us via Zoom in New York City. And of course, Bloomberg Opinion Deals and Industrials columnist Brooke Sutherland.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekdays from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live to our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, we just heard from Charlie, of course, breaking down the trade here. Keep in mind, we are on track for the S&P to see its first back-to-back weekly declines, the first time that we've seen that here in 2023. A standout, though, is those small caps up about 1.5% for the week overall and a little bit higher, certainly, in today's trade. So let's talk about the markets.
Let's talk about it with someone who knows it very well. We've got Alan Zafran, founding partner and co-CEO at IEQ Capital. He is joining Carol and myself on Zoom from Northern California. Alan, great to speak with you here. I'm going to start with the million-dollar question on all of our minds. What's the outlook for a recession in 2023? Can you read the tea leaves for us?
Madison and Carol, thanks for having me. The tea leaves are not terribly encouraging, other than to say, if we're going to have a recession, the appearances are that it will be relatively shallow, but extended. And I think the challenge is being seen in the way the market's playing out right now. It is a strange time, Madison. And the reason is the bulls are arguing that we're avoiding a recession. But if you're avoiding recession, the economy is going to be strong. And if the economy is going to be strong, that means the Fed's going to keep rates up higher and longer, which in turn is going to push down economic activity, and it's going to push down valuations and earnings estimates. And so the market wants to hear that we've already pivoted with the Fed, we've had a soft landing, and it's all steam ahead. The problem is the market isn't yet priced in fully higher rates for a longer period of time and the effect it has on reducing earnings estimates. That Alan, is the struggle we're witnessing right now.
Alan, got to say, it feels like chicken and the egg. Like I'm not quite sure, you know, it's, and this is the predicament the Fed finds itself in. And we know Fed policy, not exact, or, you know, it takes a while for these moves to really feel their impact. And so none of this is an exact science. Having said that, we do know, or a lot of conversations have been about inflation, bringing it down. It's harder, right? The first bunch is easier, but as the time drags on, it's a little bit stickier and trickier. Having said that, the investors that you talk to, are they more optimistic or pessimistic at this point? Because the earnings, and they kind of held up.
Out here in the Silicon Valley, people are guarded and concerned, not from the standpoint that it's Armageddon. There's just this feeling that we're in the middle of an elongated, slow grinding cycle that hasn't played out. And it's just going to take more time. And it's aggravating, particularly for those in Silicon Valley that have startup and early stage businesses with short runways of cash before they burn up and need more money. That's the scary part. Other much more well-positioned, solid businesses, predominantly in the S&P 500 index, don't have those near-term cash problems, but they recognize the economy is slowing as the Fed raises rates. And we all know academically, in theory, when the Fed raises the Fed rate, it takes about 12 months for the full impact of each rate hike to fully filter through in the economy. So if you believe that to be the case, the slowdown economically is still going to show up 6 to 12 months from now, not today.
This goes back to, I have to say, you know, Maddie, something that I've been talking about a lot, Ken Rogoff on surveillance this week, and just this whole idea of we don't really know what's going to happen and how this plays out, and this is what makes it so tricky.
And so interestingly, he was the one who was saying we're going to have soft without the landing, like another thing to add to our little wheel of options for where we're heading with this. I want to ask you, Alan, about tech companies, because you are in Silicon Valley and you're talking about the importance of cash. As the era of free money starts to wrap up, how are you thinking about tech companies?
Tech companies still have a fabulous quality, which they're incredibly capital light, high margin businesses with recurring revenue streams, and you get entrenched customers who just can't let go of their software based systems once they grab them. So if you have a really strong franchise and a durable product until a better competitive technology shows up, it's a winner. The challenge is these companies are valued on the basis of long-term cash flows. Mm-hmm. So those businesses are the most susceptible to rising Fed fund rates, because I'm going to use a higher discount rate when I value the present value of those distant cash flows. I do think they're increasingly attractive, but in an era where the Fed is going to keep rates higher for longer, in the short run, they're still subject to some whims of continued valuation pressure, despite how far they've come down. They're compelling long-term opportunities, but you have to be selective and ensure you're in a business that has a long enough cash runway to endure whatever slowdown might show up in the next 6 to 12 months.
I mean, Alan, this is the important conversation, right? And you write about it in your latest research about, you know, this 15-year period of easy money being over, interest rates, you know, structurally elevated amidst the return of inflation. I mean, if we are going to, forgive me, a new norm when it comes to where inflation settles and where rates settle and the Fed funds, I know they're sticking to 2%, but I think a lot can be debated about that. That means it's a whole valuation reset for asset classes, and that's the predicament we find ourselves in. And just got about a minute here.
Don't put all your eggs in one basket. Don't forget, there's a reason to own REITs. There's a reason to own value-based businesses, consumer staples, financials, which will do okay when we get back to a more upward-sloping yield curve, which is forward-looking, healthcare stocks. So despite being here in Silicon Valley, our clients are well diversified across all sectors, because we recognize that eras change, and with it, different valuations are applied and different business models can be durable despite near-term economic conditions.
All right, we're going to leave it on that note. Alan, have a great weekend. Appreciate checking in with you once again. Alan Zaffron, he's founding partner and co-CEO at IEQ Capital.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live each weekday starting at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.